Thank you very much, Ron. This is really the first of a series of meetings I hope to have in various major metropolitan areas within the next 2 or 3 weeks. You've seen our schedule for last night and the schedule we have today. We intend to do much the same in Houston, in Topeka. That's a combined trip. And then we have other plans over the next 10 days or 2 weeks. We think it's important to get out and meet with governors, editorial writers, publishers, with various mixed groups of labor management, civic leaders. All we want is an opportunity to explain what we're trying to do. And we're more than glad, through myself or the staff people who are here, to try and answer questions. I would like to start out with some bad news. I did that at the State of the Union, but I think it's oftentimes very helpful to review what's happened while a person has a job of some responsibility. And as you know, I took over the presidency August 9th, and it's almost 6 months, and let me quickly review for you what's happened in some of the more important areas in that time span. Now, when I took over, the unemployment was a little over 5%. It's now 7.1 or 2, and it's probably going up close to 8%. The cost of living when I became president was at the annual rate of 10 or 11%. It got up to 12. There's some improvement. The last report was 0.9%. There is some encouraging development in that area, but it's still much too high. When I became president, the budget for the current fiscal year was anticipated to have a deficit of about 9 to 12 billion dollars. We reported in the budget document, which was submitted yesterday, that for this current fiscal year, the deficit will be $34.7 billion. And the deficit for fiscal 76, when we took over, was anticipated to be roughly $16 billion, and now it's forecast in the document that went to the Congress yesterday, it'll be $51.9 billion. Now, those aren't very happy prospects to are the not very happy facts, I should say, during a six-month period that I happen to be president of the United States. But those are the facts of life, and I think you have to deal with them. I don't like to disavow what was done before or say that we aren't responsible for what has transpired in 6 months. I just think you have to deal with the facts of life and try to be affirmative in some solutions. And I happen to believe that we have some answers that will be the right medicine for the ailments that we have. And let me very quickly talk about the economy in the first instance. In September of this past year, at the suggestion of a substantial number of senators, both Democratic and Republican, we went through the process of an economic summit. And the consensus at that time was that inflation was our major problem. I reviewed the record the other day of all of the testimony that we took in from people all over the country. And very few at that time predicted the precipitous drop in automotive sales. Very few predicted the substantial increase in unemployment that has taken place. Most of the concern, and validly so, was the very deep apprehension about the high rate of inflation. But subsequent to October, these economic circumstances changed dramatically. not that we had licked inflation, but recession became by far the more important of the two. And so as we worked in December and January on the economic program, we came to the conclusion that if we were under any circumstances to lick our economic problems, we had to shift the emphasis, not abandon the fight against inflation, but shift the emphasis. So what we have proposed is a recommended $16 billion tax reduction, divided roughly $3 out of $4 in benefits to go to people, and $1 out of the $4 to go to business. We recommended a 12% tax rebate for all taxpayers, individual taxpayers, based on their 1974 income tax payments. And we also recommended a 12% one-year investment tax credit for business, which means for utilities from 4% to 12%, and for the rest of business from 7 to 12%. The purpose there was to stimulate business to make these improvements in their plants, in their equipment, as quickly as possible. In the case of individual income taxpayers, there's been some suggestion that we should give the tax reduction based on changes in the withholding schedules for calendar 1974. Well, that sounds like an easier, maybe a better way to do it. But that doesn't help the man who's out of a job in 1975, who might have had a job in 1974. He gets a rebate predicated on his earnings of 1974, even though he's out of a job in 1975. So if you want to help the unemployed with this $200, $300, or $500 tax rebate, you ought to do it on the basis of his income in 1974. Well, the House Committee on Ways and Means has taken our suggestions. I understand that yesterday they, in the committee, voted to make a tax reduction of about $8 billion on the basis of changes in the withholding for 1975. The speculation is that today they will probably give a $6 billion tax rebate predicated on the 1974 tax payments. Well, that isn't too far different from what we recommended. I think we could probably go along with that, although I do want to read the fine print. I think that's somewhat important. All we know is what has been reported. And I hope they will do something in the area of the investment tax credit. The best information I have from talking with the chairman is that instead of a one-year 12% investment tax credit, they may move to a permanent 10% investment tax credit. Well, we can argue whether ours is better than theirs, and obviously I would think so. But at least it's a shot in the arm to business and puts us in a more equitable position vis-a-vis business in Japan and West Germany and some of the other major industrial nations. So 10% on a permanent basis, I think, would be a major step in the right direction, certainly in the utility field. Well, the tax reductions or rebates are needed to stimulate the economy, and that's what we want first. But as a part of the package of the economic recovery program, we also felt that we had to continue the struggle against inflation. And what do we propose in that regard? If we don't do anything about federal spending, and at the same time stimulate the economic recovery, maybe we'll have a recovery for 6 or 9 or 12 months, but then we'll be right back on the inflationary problem of major proportions. And we have proposed that there should be in fiscal year 1976 a $17 billion reduction or cap on federal spending. The most controversial part of that, of course, is the proposal to not reduce, but to put a 5% cap on pay increases for federal government employees, on Social Security, on military retirement, and on federal government retirement. It's not a reduction. It's a 5% cap. It would be the difference between what the cost of living increase would be from 5% to maybe 8%. So you're asking them to save 2 to 3%, whatever the figure would be. Now, this is going to be hard, and I expect the Congress will have many difficult moments in deciding what to do. But let me just point out, we have a $51.9 billion deficit. And if they don't do something, you just add $17 billion to that $52 billion deficit. So the Congress is playing with some fire. If they pass the tax reduction and don't do anything about the spending, both are an equal, integral, important part of a total recovery plan which involves economic recovery on the one hand and a continued battle against inflation on the other. Now, let me turn very quickly to the energy program. We tried last fall to do something in the field of energy conservation by voluntary effort. We were criticized because we weren't tough enough. I happen to think it was wise to try a voluntary effort. It obviously was insufficient. A year ago, we were consuming roughly 16 million barrels of crude oil a day, 10 million per day from domestic production, 6 million per day from foreign sources. The projected increase of use of crude oil on an annual basis is somewhere between 4 and 5% per year. Now, we did make some inroads into the rate of growth, not as much as we should, but we did make some inroads in the rate of growth. But in the 12-month period from 73 to late 74, because our domestic crude production was going down, despite whatever efforts we made, we had to increase our foreign crude imports. So today, we're importing about 7.1 million barrels per day. And it's on an accelerated scale, which makes us every day of the year in the future more vulnerable to foreign government action. Our domestic production is dropping off. Our reliance on foreign crude is inevitably going up, even though we try to be conservative in what we use in industry and automobiles, et cetera. Now, everybody that I've listened to tells us that if we're going to become energy independent, or less vulnerable on foreign sources, we have to, this year, save 1 million barrels a day in foreign oil imports. 1 million barrels a day this year, and 2 million barrels a day by 1977. Now, over a year ago, the Congress and the President decided to have a total study of our energy problem It was labeled a study, energy independence. And when they got all through and they submitted to me in mid-November the evidence, it was a volume about that thick, with all of the facts and all of the choices. And for the next month or so, I went through that book with all the facts and all of the options with all of the people who were the experts. And when we got all through, we ended up with a comprehensive program to do two things: conservation on the one hand and stimulation of production on the other. And we did end up with the need to cut back foreign oil imports 1 million barrels a day this year, and 2 million barrels a day by 1977. Now, how did we think it should best be done? Our feeling is that the best approach is through the price mechanism. The alternatives are an arbitrary import quota system. That's what some recommend. We looked at it, and every one of our economic advisors had told us that that is an easy to apply, but it would have the most serious impact on our economy. The allocation, if you take 10% off or whatever the figure is, by an arbitrary figure, the impact on the economy is most severe. Now, another approach is gasoline rationing. I won't go into the details, but I just would say this. Most of the members of the Congress with whom I've talked think that gasoline rationing in this area at this time means 6 months or 9 months or maybe a year. It's a 5-year program at the minimum, and it's a 10-year program between now and 1985. Now, I look around the room, and some of you remember the gasoline rationing in World War II. Here we were faced with a military crisis, and even then, gas rationing was controversial, and toward the end of World War II, which was roughly 4 years, the incidents of black marketeering, corruption, it was accelerating at an unbelievable pace. In this peacetime period, I just don't think you can make gas rationing last, even if it is the right one, which I don't think is right. But for a 5 or 10 year period, you know it won't work. Now, and of course, everybody that you talk to about gas rationing thinks that he or she will get all they want, but everybody else is going to take a full cutback. And when you add up the gasoline, when you add up the licensed drivers throughout the country, I think we have 125 million licensed drivers. And if you predicate the gas rationing tickets on the basis of licensed drivers, the forecast is you'll pick up another 15 million overnight. So that takes you up to 140 million licensed drivers. And we have approximately 290 million gallons of gasoline available a day. So you divide 140 million drivers into 290 million gallons of gasoline, and that's, roughly 2 gallons a day. And then you have to cut back so much. So the ordinary driver will end up with about 1.75 gallons a day. And that's not very much. Now, there'll have to be regional and various other adjustments. But all I'm saying is, rationing doesn't really satisfy most people, and it certainly doesn't satisfy people in areas where there is a need to drive, in agricultural areas, in resort areas, etc. All right, so what we have tried to do is to get people to use less gasoline and fuel oil, heating oil, on the basis of the price mechanism. Now, it's painful, but we have statistics that show, because of the Arab oil price increases, that there has been not only a stop in the growth of gasoline utilization, but some cutback. I think the figures the other day showed about 2 or 3%. A reduction, not an increase. So I think the price mechanism will work. And we think it's the way to go. And the Congress, unfortunately, is not equipped to take a total package and do something about it. We put all of these proposals in one bill, and you would be surprised. It's 196 pages without the tax recommendations and without the strip mining bill proposals. Now, we sent it up to the Hill. It's about like that. And I think the Congress now has the choice. Do they want to make little piecemeal suggestions, or do they want to come up with a comprehensive plan? Now, one quick question on how the impact would be under our import duties or refinery taxes. We have imposed, as of February 1st, $1 per barrel on all foreign imported oil. We have given some exceptions to meet the particular or unique problems in New England. And we will make other exceptions as the facts justify. And we have said that we would take that off on April 1st, providing Congress acts affirmatively on a total program. What is the total program? It provides, as we have recommended it, a $2 a barrel excise tax on domestic crude, a $2 a barrel import duty on foreign crude. And we have then said we should decontrol domestic production, but provide a windfall tax on the oil companies for whatever profits they make over and above a fair rate. Now, these excises and these windfall profits and these import duties would raise between $30 and $31 billion in additional taxes that Uncle Sam collects. Now, that would increase the price of crude, of gasoline and heating oil and all petroleum products. And the estimates we have are that it will increase the cost of living on a one-shot basis approximately 2 to 2.5%. Now, how do we take care of the inequities that have been caused by this increase in the cost of fuel oil, gasoline? We take or propose that this $30 to $31 billion be returned to individuals in the following way. State and local units of government, they've had their energy costs increased by about $2 billion in a 12-month period. That would be returned to state and local units of government in the general revenue sharing formula. Business would be hit by added energy costs of about $6.5 billion in a 12-month period. They would get a change in their corporate tax rates from 48% to 42%. On a permanent basis. Individual income taxpayers would have added energy costs of about $16.1 or $2 billion. They would get their return by changing withholding rates with the emphasis on giving a better tax break to the lower income people and increasing your low income tax benefits. I don't have the precise figure on my tip of my tongue, but the low income allowance would be increased. To the non-taxpayer, the retired, for example, who wouldn't benefit by a change in the withholding, would get a direct payment of $80 per person from the federal treasury. The federal government would have about $3 billion in extra energy costs. Uncle Sam just keeps that for himself. We have another proposal that would stimulate the installation of insulation equipment for homes, and that's about $500 million, 15% up to $1,000 installation cost of insulation equipment. And for the people who don't have any income but who could save energy, we provide $55 million for the low-income people. If the federal government would buy the equipment, insulation equipment, then we would hope volunteers would actually install it for them. Well, that's the package. It provides, I think, a stimulant for increased exploration. It provides a sufficient stimulant for new sources of energy, and it provides a method of conservation. And I think we can lick the problem. And I can tell you that the reaction among our other industrialized nations has been very positive. And I think it's the right approach, both from the economy and the energy point of view. Well, I talked much too long, but I think you have to understand that it's a comprehensive program, and I'd be glad to answer any questions. Yes, Mr. Kirkland.
Mr. President, most economists, I think, agree that the size of the deficit this year, the $32 billion, is good. It stimulates the economy. Then going into the next fiscal year with perhaps a $52 billion deficit, or which could be a lot larger without the cap you described, there are those that would suggest by mid-76 we're going to be in back in that inflationary cycle in a big way, to the degree that it may be necessary to reimpose wage and price control. Do you think your advisors suggest that could happen, the necessity for that?
None of my advisors think that is going to be a realistic prospect. And I am philosophically very strongly opposed to it. So I see no reason for it substantively, and being opposed to it philosophically, I don't think the prospects are very good if I have anything to say about it. So really we're doing reasonably well on the inflation side now. And I think Arthur Burns and the members of the Federal Reserve Board are not going to be irresponsible. I think they'll follow a very responsible path in the area of monetary policy. And if they do, I think they can keep us from getting into a tremendous upsurge in inflation in 1976.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
In your conversations last evening, Mr. President, with the Southern governors, did you make any progress, do you feel, in selling your program?
I thought they were very understanding. They asked a lot of questions. In my judgment, we did make some progress. And I was, incidentally, very impressed with the capabilities and the point of view. I was outnumbered party-wise, but we didn't discuss the issues on a partisan basis. And I was very impressed with them individually and I think it was a very productive evening. We spent from, 7:30 until about 11:30, and we didn't agree on everything, but they understand my problems, and we have taken some of their suggestions and recommendations, and there are some good ones, and we'll take a look at them. If all of them go as well as that, we'll be very pleased. I might say, totally off the record, it was a lot more pleasant than the one I had with the New England government. And further off the record, they knew a lot more of the facts than their counterparts from New England. Yes.
President, comment on the depletion allowance, and was this a part of your package? Congress seems to be sold on the idea of phasing this out. It would appear that this would stimulate domestic exploration and production of oil and gas if it were increased rather than decreased.
We did not recommend the elimination of the 22.5% depletion allowance. We don't think that that ought to be a part of, number one, the economic tax proposals, because it's so controversial. And we don't think that it is something that ought to be included in the energy package. My predecessor and I, too, think that you can phase it out as far as foreign oil exploration. But I have reservations about doing it domestically for the reasons that you give. And actually, there's very little opposition among our people for the phasing out of the foreign oil depletion allowance. Yes, sir.
Mr. President, yesterday I had the opportunity to hear Jack Sheehan, one of the Federal Reserve Board governors in my hometown in went back and traced the history of federal spending. He indicated tremendous concern over this projected $51 billion deficit. And of course, my question now really, I guess, more of a concern than a question, but I'd like your reaction. I'm greatly sympathetic with the tremendously complex job you have, and I'm tremendously appreciative of how you work to try to do something about it. I'm inclined to buy your energy program. As I pointed out to Jack Sheehan, even Arthur Burns says we've got to have a tax cut in the immediate future to do something. But he pointed out very effectively that 10 years ago that the $1 billion, the $51 billion deficit, if it runs 2 years, and he said the president's always understated. But those 2 years, he pointed out, is more, the deficit is more than in 1964, 10 years ago, was total. And I know you're concerned about this, but how can a very liberal, can we get control over spending in this liberal Congress we've got in the future? Can we, or what the heck can we do to get us to stop spending a whole lot more money than we ever have any hope to generate? And I'm very concerned about our future from that standpoint, and I really would like your reaction.
Well, if you by any chance have the time to look through the budget, and this is, you know, they, with great pride, the Office of Management and Budget presented me with the first copy off the press. Well, the facts and figures in here are very disturbing. But we laid them right out. We didn't try to gloss them over. And let me point out one of the most disturbing things. If you just extend the rate of growth of what is called income payments or income supplements to individuals, Social Security, retirement, et cetera, at the present rate, which has been 9% for the last 10 years, is it, Jim? You don't add anything. You just go at the present rate. And related to the increase in the GNP for the last 10 years, which is about 3.5%, you see what happens. This rate of income supplements just multiplies, and pretty soon it has a devastating effect, and it ends up that government actually is paying half of the people, so to speak. And it just scares the devil out of me.
And look at what the governor of Georgia had to say in the papers last night about your proposal to put a cap on the increase. In our political, you know, how do we, where people get elected by spending money to the people? That is really what scares me.
Well, I understand the political problem of putting a cap after having run successfully for 13 elections. I understand their political problem. But there comes a time when they have to take another look. Because if the rate of growth of federal spending increases, or continues, not increases, we're in very dire trouble. Now, there's a question was raised last night. How could I justify an increase in proposed spending from $85 billion a year to $94 billion for the Department of Defense? And that's a good question. But first, let me slice off one part of that $94 billion, which has nothing to do with our current readiness, nothing. $6.9 billion of that $94 billion is for retired pay for military personnel. $6.9 billion out of the $94 billion has nothing to do with current readiness. That's a payment for past service for people who serve 20 or more years in the military. And you might be interested, when I went on the Committee on Appropriations and the Defense Subcommittee on 1953, it was $400 million a year. It's now $6.9 billion a year. And it's going up, and it'll soon be $8 billion a year. But so just forget that. That has nothing to do with current readiness in weapons or people or research and development. So you're really talking about $88 billion a year. Now, we believe in, and I think rightly so, that people in the military ought to want to have a career service, and if so, they ought to be paid in a reasonable, comparable way. And so about 4 years ago, pay and allowance for military personnel was substantially increased. Today, the federal government is paying people in the Department of Defense out of their total budget roughly 52 to 53% of every dollar spent by the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine goes for personnel. And so the percentage, and that's gone up from about 35% to 50+%. So you have less money available for research and development, for procurement, for operation and maintenance. Now, that wouldn't be too bad, except there is a very recent study, and I've looked at it and analyzed it. For the last 5 years, the Soviet Union has spent 25% more per year on their military budget than we have. And that's on the best method of using their rubles and our dollars so that you get a fair comparison. Now, I think we are strong militarily. I believe we are fully adequate militarily. But a 25% difference over the next 5 years could present a very serious military security problem to us. Now, one other thing, We went to Vladivostok. We reached, I think, a good agreement with a cap on launchers and a cap on MIRVs. But if we're going to have this essential equivalency, which is what we got, we have to go from Polaris's to Tridents, and those are expensive. We have to go from Minuteman 1 and 2 to Minuteman 3. We have to go from B-52s, which are now 15 plus years old, to B-1s. Doesn't do any good to have the second best missile, the second best submarine, and the second best aircraft. They don't maintain the peace, and they certainly don't win the conflict. So if we want to have this stability, which is important, we have to spend an adequate amount. And I don't believe in giving the military everything they want. One comment that follows out the point you made, you see, we've had this 9% increase in growth every year in income transfer payments. Now, people have said the way to finance that is to take money out of the Defense Department. And it has been done. But there comes to be a point of diminishing return. If we continue to finance this 9% annual growth of income transfer payments out of the Defense Department, in 10 years, there won't be one soldier with one rifle. Not one soldier with one rifle. You can't do it. So we have to get some handle on these income transfer payments and not deplete our military capability. Yes, ma'am.
I understand and appreciate your willingness to talk frankly about the bad news, the economy, but I'm concerned that most people aren't in a position to do anything with the bad news once they get it. I wondered whether the tax relief to industries should or could be tied to reemployment, or whether you're going to promote or start any reemployment programs on a federal or even a local basis.
Well, of course, we do have the Emergency Employment Program, Public Service Program. I would rather have the increase in employment come out of the private sector. Several of the suggestions made by governors last night were in that area rather than pure unemployment compensation or public service employment. We think that by the end of the second quarter of this calendar year, we will have gone to the valley, so to speak, and we'll start going up. And I think industry will be in a position of increasing private employment. And we certainly will do all we can to promote it.
Mr. President, maybe you ought to save some of your answers for the reporters.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed meeting all of you and being with you, and I'm deeply grateful for
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. President. Honored to be here.